A good biography is more than the facts of someone's life. My guest Michael Holroyd is one of England's leading biographers, and he sees his job as interpreting his subject's life and the times in which he lived, revealing truths that can inform our lives today. George Bernard Shaw is the subject of Holroyd's latest biography. He began the research over 13 years ago. The second in his three-volume Shaw biography has just been published. Part of the reason it's taking this long is that Shaw left behind 55 plays, including Man and Superman and Pygmalion, 5 novels, volumes of literary and music criticism, and approximately 250,000 letters. Holroyd's previous books include a biography of the Welsh painter Augustus John and the British writer Lytton Strachey, who was among the writers and artists known as the Bloomsbury Group. In 1985, Holroyd became the president of the English branch of PEN, the International Writers' Organization. Shaw, by the way, was an early member. I asked Michael Holroyd if a biographer needs to empathize with his subject.
I don't think it's necessary to identify with your subject. I don't have a beard, for example. I think that you have to be interested. There has to be some sympathy with your subject. I always see biography as a form of foreign travel, where you learn a new language, you pick up a new culture, you see a new political and literary landscape, and eventually, after sometimes rather a long journey, you come home having added something to yourself, which you hope you can give your readers.
Is there something that you feel, I'm sure there's a lot of things that you feel you've added to yourself through studying Shaw?
Yes, I have. It's been for me a life-changing book, I think, and I would certainly like it to be that for some readers, if that were possible. That would be ideal from my point of view. I've had to study a great number of things that I didn't know before. I had to work to some extent against the grain of my natural talent, and that's a risky business, but it can be an enriching business to the text, I think. And people sometimes ask me whether I like Shaw. And, in fact, I do, but that's not the basis of the biography. I'm not just trying to say to the reader, here's a jolly good chap, this is a swell guy. I'm trying to do something much more complicated. Indeed, I'm trying to pay the reader a compliment of saying, here is human nature in its relation with nature itself, if you like. And this is yesterday, and this is how it affects today. That's what I'm trying to do.
You've said that you wanted to present a new Shaw, a Shaw for our time.
Very much so, because when I started, I thought I was writing a book of cultural history. As I went on, and as we've come into the late 80s, I have realized that many of the subjects which he addressed, disarmament, medical ethics, the connection between Ireland and England, the peaceful invasion of Britain by the United States, and many other subjects, are in fact part of the current democratic debate. And so I have felt that it had the book a topical relevance that I never realized when I started it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly because Shaw had prophetic instincts, rather like his friend H.G. Wells. I see him as born ahead of his time, which made it sometimes awkward for him during his time, because he seemed very odd. But many of the things he wrote and said in his time now seem absolutely sensible and wise. I mean, his championship of women, for example, in politics, seemed quite extraordinary in the 1890s and the early part of the century. But now they are part of the current scene. And it's very interesting to plot yesterday and today in that way.
For our listeners who aren't well acquainted with Shaw's writing or his plays, where would you place him in terms of English literature, his importance?
I think he is a very important playwright. I think that he started in Britain the play of ideas. He was opposed to Victorian pantomime and simply sentimental melodrama. He saw the theatre as an extremely important forum. What happened earlier in this century was that young people came in to the theatre, listened to Shaw's plays, heard completely new ideas, and came out as modern radicals, 20th century radicals. And he used laughter as a sort of anesthetic for the operation he wished to perform on British society. He wanted to change society, to change unequal private property into commonwealth, but he didn't want to do it through bloodshed. I've called this second volume The Pursuit of Power. He wanted power through the word. He wanted writers to be able to change the mind of a country, the way people thought, and therefore the legislation.
Michael Holroyd is my guest, and volume two of his three-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw has just been published. How did you get to write this biography, which is, by the way, the authorized biography of Shaw?
Well, I was chosen to do it by the three legatees of the estate, which is the British Museum, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and the National Gallery of Ireland. And how they decided on me, I have not the slightest idea, except that they had read my previous books on Lytton Strachey and part of my Augustus John, I think. And it was on the basis of that that I was asked. And it was a great honour for me, and it was also a great terror as well, because I realised that this was a gigantic business. Shaw touched life at so many points. He believed that an author's business was to mind everybody else's business. And he, that's what he did. He minded G.K. Chesterton's business and H.G. Wells's business, Mrs. Patrick Campbell's business. He involved himself not only in the theatre, but in music and politics, but all the new scientific gadgets of the day, the wireless, the camera, the motor car. In a sense, his life is a history of the times, a cultural, political, and artistic history of the times. So it's was a bit of a terrifying prospect to me.
You know, sometimes a biographer will say with a certain amount of pride, this is the unauthorized biography of my subject, as if, you know, in the unauthorized biography they can slip in real truths, truths too powerful or too painful for the authorized biography. Did you ever feel that there would be any restrictions on you writing the authorized biography?
There have been no restrictions at all. Arrangement I had with the estate is that I could be defrocked as an authorized biographer, but there would be certain advantages to me in that. So everything was well balanced. Also, I haven't had to deal with families. I have dealt with committees, and it's quite a different exercise. Finally, I think the danger of biographers is to aggrandize their subject or fall in love with their subject. I have tried very carefully to give the opposite point of view. When Chesterton or Wells or Mrs. Patrick Campbell disagree with Shaw, I have given their best words in disagreement so people can take sides. And I have concealed very often my own personal opinion because that's not part of what was going on at the time.
Well, you say that you think it's a danger to fall in love with your subject. In fact, you've said that you think Shaw has been overprotected by those who treasure him. In what ways?
Well, I think that there is a tendency, as I say, amongst people to make a saint of the writer they particularly like in some way or other. Shaw is the saint of sometimes the lonely. People who, as I say, are out of step with their times. And although his life is a heroic story and does give comfort to people who feel they've been dealt a bad hand in life because he played what was originally a very bad hand, he played that hand brilliantly and also showed how every disadvantage is a potential asset in disguise. Not everyone can do that. But Shaw represents those people very well. And so they are naturally protective of him. And I understand that. But Shaw is not only for the Shavians. He is, as I see it, for the world.
Mm-hmm. What about the privacy issue? Sometimes estates or families will try to withhold certain letters that might detail intimacies that they feel would be best left unknown.
Yes,
to the public.
Yes, I can completely understand that. I think there is a difference between a living person and a dead person. I can tell the difference quite clearly. And the difference is this, that while we are alive, we all need protection. We all need the evasions and sentimentalities that ring our lives about. And I would respect that. But when we are dead, I think that those particular protections are no longer needed. And you pay a compliment to the dead by saying that the dead can be still kept in employment for the living and more truth can now be told. Because if we only have those evasions and sentimentalities and half-truths, then we get a completely false picture of how life is actually lived. And if we think that our role models live the sort of lives that they never did, in fact, live, we make ourselves extremely unhappy. So I would want to tell as much truth as I can find out.
No, we were talking about the privacy of dead writers who are being chronicled by a biographer. One thing that was very controversial in your biography of Lytton Strachey was that you revealed that he had been a homosexual. Were you criticized for that?
I was very much criticized, not by the family, strangely enough, but by some members of the reading public. And not only because I revealed that Strachey was a practicing homosexual, but also other people were, including Maynard Keynes. Maynard Keynes, the economist, was considered, and perhaps still is considered, to be one of the linchpins of Western capitalism. So I was accused, when my book came out, of giving comfort to the enemy, of subverting our own way of life. And when President Nixon said, we are all Keynesians now, there was a sort of guffaw of laughter. sometime after that, I believe he left office. I make no claims for my biography.
Well, I guess this gets back to what you were saying before, that the dead can still be put to good use by the living in having their real lives revealed. If we know that people who had been assumed to be straight were actually homosexual, it kind of changes the view of homosexuality as this very, very minority.
And it also changes the view, really, of what is normality.
Exactly, right.
I think that there is a mainstream of human nature, and there are all sorts of tributaries in it. And there is no need for people to feel freakish or odd or part of something that's been left behind, because the narrative of life is a very broad one, and we are all part of it. And that, I hope, is one of the things that biography can do. You sometimes can pick up a biography and it can speak for you. It can say perhaps more eloquently than you can what your position in life is, what your secrets are, what your feelings, what your thoughts are. And the other thing it can do is to say, this is someone utterly unlike you, but enable you to understand that people who disagree with you, who had different backgrounds and different opinions, are not necessarily crooks or fools. So it increases your tolerance of people.
One of the things you write about Shaw is that he had a virtually sexless marriage.
Yes, but I hope I also show that he was a passionate man.
Mm-hmm.
The paradox was that he and his wife were, to some extent, lovers before they married, and not after they married. And there were reasons for that. I mean, partly he was very ill at the time of his marriage. They were in their 40s. And it soon became not part of the married relationship, sex. And he thought that people, the basis, shall we say, for a happy marriage was an intimate friendship between complementary natures, rather than simply a sexual attraction. If you married for life simply on sexual attraction, you might produce very good babies, that's one thing, but marriage would turn into a prison which you could call wedlock, and that was not a good basis for marriage. That's the point that he was also not just making and writing, but enacting in his life.
Now, how do you think that this information about Shaw's personal life changes the way we would read any of his plays, for instance?
I think it changes them a lot, and I hope it will encourage new and younger directors to stage Shaw's plays in a slightly different way.
What would be different?
I think the orchestration of the suppressed emotion, because there is a subtext, a passionate subtext to the play, which represents what was suppressed in the life. And I do believe, as I said, that he is a more passionate man than is popularly recognized. I think sometimes people think of him as having only ink in his veins and having been born with a long white beard. And I am going to try and supplant that bearded literary Superman with a recognizable human being who had a considerable vulnerability and a need to protect himself, which no longer exists.
Michael Holroyd is my guest, and he's completing a biography of George Bernard Shaw. Volume 2 has just been published. Volume 3 is still in the works. Your biographies are about Bernard Shaw. You leave the name George off, although you refer to him as GBS in the text. Why did he drop the name George?
His father was called George, and he was brought up in a ménage à trois, Catholic Protestant ménage à trois, in Ireland in the 1850s, 1860s. And the other man in the ménage à trois was also called George. And Shaw wondered for quite a time whether perhaps he was illegitimate. And that word George, which he had and which the two men in the household had, he dropped because it was a symbol of his uncertainty, his unsureness, if you like. And so he, on all his title pages, you will see just Bernard Shaw. Don't George me, he always said. He never Georged himself. But then when he became a public figure, he had this shorthand, GBS, for his public personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about your work as a biographer, I feel it's only fitting to ask you a few biographical questions about...
Yeah.
About your own life. I should mention here that you are married to the novelist Margaret Drabble, who will be our guest on this program in just a few days. And I was very interested to hear that, I hope you don't mind being asked about this, but that you live separately, although you are married. And I find that a very interesting arrangement in the sense that an assumption is always made that if two people aren't living together, that somehow they're less serious in their relationship toward each other. And to be married, which is the kind of ultimate statement about your commitment to each other, and to remain living separately would be seen as a contradiction by many people.
If Margaret and I were not married, everybody would say we were living together. Since we are married, everybody says we are living apart. Both are great simplifications. As it were, live together every week. But we have separate houses about 20 minutes apart. Mainly it came through accident, through work reasons. My place is full of Shaw books, hers of other books. And we've kept that on. And it's worked very well, having that distance. Living apart perhaps gives too much of a remote feel to it. Let me say this, that we are always pleased to see each other, and we see each other every week.
Mm-hmm.
And we always spend sort of long weekends together. And usually, though not this time, we travel together abroad.
I'll tell you what I'm curious about. I really understand the inclination to live separately and to have, you know, private places. But I'd be interested in why you decided to get married.
It makes life...
And I ask this because a lot of people get married since they will be co-owning a house and sharing possessions. It's part of a legal contract in addition to a statement about the meaning of the relationship.
It was a commitment, is the first thing. It gives each other the priority. It makes life simpler. We are sort of invited out as a couple and enjoy that. What goes wrong with a lot of marriages is that people are living absolutely on top of one another. You must realize with two writers, their homes are also their offices. so we possibly spend nearly as much time together as many other people, but we are at home, which is our offices, so we both have a home and office and a home and office, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. One last question. When is volume 3 of your show biography scheduled for publication, and is it written yet?
Is my publisher listening to this, do you think? it's not wholly written, though. I've written about a third of it, it's a very difficult volume to write, but I want to try and make a case for two or three very late, unknown Shaw plays as being more modern, futuristic, and surreal, and very much part of present-day theatre. If I succeed in doing that, I'll be very pleased.
Will you be real pleased when the whole project's over?
I shall be... If I feel I've done it well, I will be very pleased, but my occupation will be gone.
You'll do another biography?
Never. I don't think I could do another one after this. This will have been over 15 years' commitment of energy, emotion, thought. I think a long holiday is what I'm really concentrating on.
A sentiment I can understand. Thank you very much for talking with us about writing biography. Thank you.
Thank you.